Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
What a week this has been for the Kennedy family, as well as for America at large. 40 years ago today, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. The family obviously is remembering. Earlier in the week, Ted Kennedy had his brain surgery, and yesterday, Caroline Kennedy was named to Barack Obama's vice presidential search committee. We will talk about the RFK legacy and the comparisons of Barack Obama to a Kennedy, including the pros and cons of that, with three guests in just a minute. But first, let's hear 35 seconds of Robert Kennedy's last speech at the Ambassador Hotel after winning the California primary.
What I think is quite clear is that we can work together in the last analysis, and that what has been going on within the United States over the period of the last 3 years, the divisions, the violence, the disenchantment with our society, the divisions, whether it's between blacks and whites, between the poor and the more affluent, or between age groups, or on the war in Vietnam, that we can start to work together. We are a great country and a selfish country and a compassionate country. And I intend to make that my basis for running and over the period of the next year.
Robert Kennedy, just before he was killed on June 4th, and then the assassination was just after midnight on June 5th, 1968. With us, Pete Hamill, the legendary New York journalist and novelist who was in the room when RFK was shot and has the foreword to a new book about Robert Kennedy called The Time It Was, Bobby Kennedy in the 60s, Photographs and Text by Bill Eppridge. Also, New York Magazine writer Chris Smith, who has a piece this week about Barack Obama as an honorary Kennedy, and Dr. Frederick Harris, professor of political science at Columbia University and director of the Center on African-American Politics and Society there. Welcome all of you to WNYC today. Thank you so much for coming on. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Pete, the anniversary today is the killing of RFK, not the milestones in the life of RFK. We have a whole generation listening who never saw Bobby Kennedy alive. Where do you start? What was really important about him? And for that matter, what set him apart from the other Kennedys? Tall order, huh? Do we have Pete Hamill? Maybe we lost Pete Hamill.
Oh, yeah. I am. I'm hearing you very faintly, Brian.
Okay. Were you able to hear the question?
I did, yeah. I think there's different ways to look at Kennedy. I think you have to separate Kennedy, but I like to think of it as Robert Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy before the assassination of his brother Jack and afterwards. The one I knew was after the assassination in the 60s. When he had become someone quite different in many ways from the cliche was the ruthless Bobby, who was at the service of his brother exclusively, and before that worked for Joe McCarthy and other people. I think there were two different people involved, mainly because I think he learned from the assassination certain lessons. One was a lesson about time. You don't have time to wait 2, 3, 4, 10 years before you do X, Y, or Z. You had to do it in the time of your life. And I think there was a kind of, the thing that appealed most to me and a lot of other people was that he had acquired a kind of fatalism to him. That you must do everything you can no matter what might happen. And I think that carried him right to that kitchen 40 years ago today.
Pete, I heard you on Fresh Air yesterday, and I was struck by a number of the things that you said. One of them was that Robert Kennedy had a keen awareness of the two faces of politics. And I don't know if I'm quoting you precisely, but the difference between what you could say in public and what you had to keep private
right.
to get the job done. Can you dig into that a little bit?
Well, just as an example of that, I mean, he talked about several things with me that I remember after all these years. He talked about, for example, doing something to divide the CIA's operations wing from the intelligence gathering function. He didn't like the idea, even though while Jack Kennedy was president, he knew about what was going on in terms of, say, plans to kill Fidel Castro. I think he realized that that was a mistake to confuse intelligence gathering, which is absolutely necessary in a country like ours, and actually doing something about it. The James Bond phenomenon, that was one thing. He clearly had intended to end the war in Vietnam that first year. He wanted to do that, call a peace conference, as Nixon eventually did, sit down and say, okay, here's the deal. He wanted to do that. I think those things, had they been executed, might have saved many human lives. I think there were more than 20,000 GIs killed under Nixon by prolonging the war till you got a perfect solution, and possibly as many as 1 million Vietnamese. So that might have been avoided. Had he been able to do things that he was on his agenda, but he knew it didn't fit into making a stump speech. They're complicated. I think also in private, politicians need energy. The job itself is consuming. The election, the primary season we just got through with, two very intelligent people spent months and months and months and months without reading a single poem. they have to read, you know. I try to live in my old age now and read a poem every night like it was a prayer, which is what the best poetry is like.
You can't live on Google News alone.
No, huh? You can't, or talking points or the yeah. digest of the day's press.
Let me bring our other guests in here and also invite our listeners either on whatever thoughts you may have on this 40th anniversary of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, especially if you were around then, and any thoughts any of you may have on the comparisons that are being made between Barack Obama and any of the Kennedys. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And before we get to Obama and the Kennedys and Chris Smith, our guest from New York Magazine, who writes about this week, Professor Harris, the assassination of RFK came just 2 months after the assassination of Martin Luther King. And I know that you have thought about the effect on America and maybe on America ever since of those two things coming so close together. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. As I'm sure your guests and your audience knows already, 1968 was a turbulent year. And it's a year that's a part of the nation's collective memory, part of its national memory about itself. And many have pinpointed 1968 as a time when Americans became more cynical about politics, less trusting of government institutions and politicians. This sense of hopelessness began to creep into the nation's consciousness, but also, most importantly, I think, the sense of fear. So, you know, I don't have a direct connection. I'm a part of this in-between generation. I was only 5 years old.
Uh-huh.
And I can remember, for instance, I do have a direct memory, my grandmother sort of crying and saying that, oh, my God, Dr. King has been assassinated. And growing up in households with grandmothers, aunts and uncles and parents who had this calendar every year of Martin Luther King, John Kennedy, and Robert F. Kennedy. And there was, again, this sense of loss, this sense of hopelessness that set in throughout the 70s and basically to into the 1980s when we see Ronald Reagan, who tries to bring hope again to America, but that's another subject. But
and he was also shot, though he survived. Do you think that there is a straight line, or is it just too much of a stretch with all that's happened in the 40 years in between to say that there's a some kind of straight line to that hopelessness that you referred to after those assassinations and the hope associated, at least in some quarters, with Barack Obama?
Yeah, I certainly do. He's really brought people, young people, African-Americans, into the political process. He's talked about the sense of hope, optimism, and making people feel good about themselves, but also telling people that they themselves can be agents of change, something that was a part of the spirit of the 1960s. So to see him as a candidate, to see him, you know, bringing crowds, 75,000, 25,000, of a diverse group of people, really harks back to that moment, that golden moment in 1968 when Robert Kennedy ran, and really pinpointing the possibilities of change, possibilities of hope, and the spirit of optimism that's very characteristic of what we see ourselves as Americans.
Chris Smith, the title of your article in New York Magazine is The Honorary Kennedy, Ted and Caroline Anointed Barack Obama as the Candidate Best Qualified to Carry on the JFK Legacy, but to live up to it, he has to put it in the past. And Chris, this is a really good article on kind of the process in the Kennedy compound or compounds on coming to Obama. Not all of them did, to live up to it, you say he has to put it in the past. We'll get to that in a minute. But what about the process? Was it a slam dunk from the beginning that at least Ted Kennedy and Caroline Kennedy would come out for Obama?
No. Within the Kennedy family, there was as much division, argument, you know, argument in the friendly sense. It's the family business, and they've had a long, rich history of debating questions back and forth. But it was a long process that reflected, I think, the division you saw in the Democratic Party over the past 16, 17 months, that there were Kennedy family members with close personal ties to Bill and or Hillary, or who agreed with her sort of worldview, Bobby Kennedy Jr.'s best words, you know, that what you needed was a president willing to engage in a fist fight. You know, there was an element that liked that pugnacity or that realism that they saw in Hillary. And then there were others, and most dramatically, Caroline and Ted, who were looking for a candidate who they thought could inspire the country in this moment, who hearkened back to the best parts of the Kennedy legacy, or what they would like the Kennedy legacy in politics to be, the spirit of idealism, the touching of imaginations in the public, and in particular the bringing in of young people to the political process. For Ted Kennedy in particular, that was an important factor, not to mention the fact that he thought Bill and Hillary went over the line in calling him, in trying to pressure him into endorsing Hillary, and in some of Bill's public comments about race and Obama. And going forward, it's a very interesting thing. You know, Obama and David Axelrod talked to me in particular about how the endorsements were a boon at the time they came, but that Obama's appeal and his agenda is very much forward-looking. And I've been to a bunch of Obama rallies where you talk to intelligent, informed voters who are 25 and younger, for whom Bobby and Jack Kennedy are very much textbook figures. You know, they have an appreciation of them, but it was a very long time ago for those folks, for those voters who've been excited by Obama this time around. And, you know, Obama has soft-pedaled his carrying of the mantle, his stepping into the Kennedy shoes in that respect, because he knows that, you know, what comes next is what's important both to the country and to the people he's trying to get to vote for him.
Why do you say that he has to put the Kennedy, that, you know, this idea of an honorary Kennedy behind him in order to live up to it? What's the danger for him in allowing himself to be identified with it?
Well, partly it's the very different times that the men have lived in. Partly it's the fact that, Bobby and Jack, for all, particularly Bobby's identification with the lower middle class and the poor and his promotion of, you know, an anti-poverty agenda. Obama comes from a very different place in his life and his biography, and he's not a nostalgia candidate. He's a young man himself who's appealing to young voters whose problems are very different from what the country and the population faced in the 60s. And the parallels are inexact. You know, the nation is not nearly in a place of trauma like it was in the 60s. I don't mean to minimize in any way the effects of Iraq or the
9/11.
Yeah, 9/11 and the folks who are fighting for us now. But there's not that sense of urgency or emergency that there was 40 years ago. And, you know, for a lot of people, the Kennedys are very complicated. You know, it's not an entirely clean and uplifting political history, and I think Obama's aware of those complications.
We have to take a break. We'll continue in a minute. We'll get our three guests to mix it up a little bit as we talk more about this idea of Barack Obama as an honorary Kennedy on this 40th anniversary of the assassination of Robert Kennedy. And as we go to this break, let's hear about a half a minute of Robert Kennedy speaking in Indianapolis just after the assassination of Martin Luther King.
What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we reflect on this 40th anniversary of the assassination of Robert Kennedy, and also talk about the comparisons between Obama and John or Robert Kennedy. There's an article in New York Magazine this week called The National Interest, The Honorary Kennedy. It says Ted and Caroline anointed Barack Obama as the candidate best qualified to carry on the JFK legacy, but to live up to it, he has to put it in the past. We have the author of that article, New York Magazine's Chris Smith, along with Dr. Frederick Harris, professor of political science at Columbia University and director of the Center on African-American Politics and Society there, and Pete Hamill, the journalist and novelist who most recently has an essay that's the introduction to a book of photographs, mostly of the RFK campaign by Bill Eppridge, called A Time It Was, Bobby Kennedy in the 60s. And we'll take your phone calls in a couple of minutes. You can call in right now, and we'll get to your calls in just a few minutes on both of these questions, just any reflection on the 40th anniversary of the RFK assassination and this idea of Obama as an honorary Kennedy in any sense. 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692, or post to our comments page at WNYC.org. Pete Hamill, what does it make you think or feel when you hear the Obama-Kennedy connection and Obama referred to in any sense as an honorary Kennedy or someone expected to pick up the mantle of JFK in some sense or RFK?
Well, I agree with Chris. I think it is 40 years ago. There are many, many people 39 years old who never heard of Robert Kennedy.
I mean, they say it themselves, right?
Jack Kennedy is an airport, the name of an airport. You know, so I think for a certain number of people, my age, for example, they remember both, and they were very important to certain people. Jack Kennedy was as important to Catholics as Obama is to some blacks. In terms of saying, let's get this over with, and then we can get back to business.
And Professor Harris, you know, Caroline Kennedy really kind of foisted this, I don't want to say foisted this conversation on us, but certainly furthered the idea. I mean, some people were making the comparison anyway after some of Obama's speeches, after Iowa. Is one big example, making the comparison between the way he was inspiring people and the way JFK or Martin Luther King did. And then Caroline Kennedy, daughter of JFK, came out and said explicitly, he's the best candidate. He's the first candidate in 40 years who I think can carry on my father's legacy. So she gave us this to some degree.
Yeah, I think she did. But also I think the campaign itself, the Obama campaign, is very conscious of this link. And I think they cultivated in many ways. I mean, Michelle Obama looks like she's out of a 1960s sort of, you know, fashion look. In many ways, some said she's cultivated that look. So I think there's some degree of symbolism that's operating here. But on the substantive side, I think it's interesting that I've heard very little critique from, either from the media or even the political opposition, is that Obama, in many ways, sort of has cultivated or is likened to JFK in the sense that of giving inspiring speeches, talking about bringing the country together, bringing the people together, the sense of optimism. But on the substantive side, he's talked very little about poverty. In fact, he's been doing poorly among the places that Robert Kennedy visited, the Appalachian Range, very little support. And secondly, for the generation that has a direct connection to that era, particularly older voters, he didn't do very well among that group, as opposed to Hillary Clinton. So in many ways, I think there's some symbolism that's going on, but from a concrete substantive position, I think the connection is pretty thin.
Pete Hamill, I know you have to leave us. Do you have time for one more question, or you are up against it right now?
But I do think that you got to, Brian, remember how different the context was. There is no draft now. There was a draft in 68. The Tet Offensive happened at the end of January, early February. The upheavals of 68 were not unique to us. They were happening in France. They happened in Prague. So there was a climate in the air. The kids that rallied to Kennedy in 68 were the children of the GI Bill. And they were the first, and many of them were the first kids in the history of their families who ever went to universities on their own without serving in the military.
Pete, I know you got to go, and your publicist is telling us that they need you. You probably have to go on some network somewhere. So thanks a lot for coming on with us.
And
we really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. And hello, fellow members of the panel.
And we are still here with Dr. Frederick Harris from Columbia University's Center on African American Politics and Society and Chris Smith, political columnist for New York Magazine, who wrote about, among other things, Obama's need to shake off the Kennedy legacy. You know, I want to acknowledge, Chris, what a danger zone the idea of comparing Obama to a Kennedy has become because of the assassination risk. And even more so after Hillary Clinton's recent remark about staying in the race just in case. One colleague yesterday was very squeamish about even having this conversation on the air. Can we address the risk and the Kennedy connection?
I'm wary of it myself, you know, emotionally as much as anything else, but certainly. And to digress for one second, and I'll answer your question more directly, but indirectly, and to be Pete's publicist myself for a second. In his extraordinary essay, he touches on this, and I was reminded by the clip you played of Kennedy, RFK's remarks after Martin Luther King's assassination. As Pete writes in his extraordinary and funny and sad essay, that was a spontaneous speech that RFK made in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
And it remains just a remarkable and impressive thing. More directly, yes, it's an amazing thing to me for all the reasons you listed, whether it's Ted Kennedy's illness or Caroline Kennedy's involvement or the anniversary of Robert F. Kennedy's assassination. It's a remarkable thing. All this time later, the hold the Kennedy family has on the political and cultural imagination of this country. And that's one of the reasons, to answer an earlier question, to answer this question, Hillary revived it, you know, with her sort of crass remarks about Bobby Kennedy's assassination. All of this is part of the reason that the Obama campaign, in David Axelrod's words, has really tried to walk a line in drumming up the Kennedy associations. Because Obama, politically and just on the human level, very much needs to be his own man in this campaign. And he's breaking barriers. You know, the first black candidate of a major American political party, to weight him even further with the ghosts of the Kennedy family, with Martin Luther King Jr. I had one of Obama's closest friends in Congress, Arthur Davis from Alabama, point out to me that the day after the Democratic convention ends in Denver in August will be the anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And so he expects Obama, in his, you know, acceptance in Denver, to reference that. So Obama's carrying a lot of ghosts with him as he runs for president, and that's a hard thing because the man's, you know, going to make mistakes. He's, you know, really leery of raising hopes even further than necessary, because then it becomes very easy for him to let people down.
And Dr. Harris, anything on this? Because I admit that I got the willies watching Obama in St. Paul just the other night after the last primaries, in that big public hall, going hand to hand into the crowd for a while, you know. And again, there's a reluctance to even say this publicly because you don't want to stir up any of the crazies who are out there. But we're all feeling it, and we all know it, so we might as well acknowledge it.
Yes, at least a lot of people have had the willies for quite a while. I mean, not only in Minnesota, but also in that huge crowd in Oregon, 75,000. And if we go back early in the primary, this was a concern among many black voters, particularly in South Carolina. I don't know if you guys remember where the reluctance initially of black voters, particularly black women, to support Barack Obama is because they thought that something would happen to him.
Hmm. And Michelle has expressed it publicly.
Yes, and she's expressed it publicly. And also, you know, there's been a beefing up of detail, security detail for Barack Obama. These are ghosts. And also a part of this sense of fear that set in 1968 is a part of what happened during the 1960s. And for a lot of black voters and voters, younger voters during that time, that sense of hopelessness set in because, you know, not only was it Robert Kennedy, it was John Kennedy, it was Martin Luther King, but also Malcolm X, who were assassinated. These people who many thought were in the prime of their life, they were about social change, social justice. And somehow, as I've heard over the years, is that whenever there's a leader who emerges who is really going to do something for the country, something happens to them. And I think that in a lot of people's guts, there's this sense of fear. And Barack Obama has been remarkable in the sense that he's not talked about it. He hasn't expressed it. And we know historically when there are other blacks who've run before the presidency. Shirley Chisholm, there were death threats on her. And there were also with Jesse Jackson in 84 and 88. So what's happening in regards to Barack Obama as a viable black presidential candidate, or now the Democratic nominee, is nothing new. So
let's take some calls and read some of the really interesting comments that are coming in on our comments page. David in Brooklyn wants to take some take issue with something. In fact, a few people did, and David's going to carry their water, taking issue with something that that Chris, you said. David in Brooklyn, hi.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Your commentator, I'm not sure of his name. I'm sorry.
Chris Smith, writer for New York Magazine. Go ahead.
Said something earlier about there being a lack of a sense of urgency or emergency in this country. In relation to what's happening now with the election compared to the 60s. And I just reacted so vehemently against that statement that I had to call. Let me see if I can put everything in order. I lived through the 60s, and I demonstrated in Washington against the war, and everyone had this tremendous feeling of fear and anger, as your commentator said. There was just this sense of outrage and not knowing what was going to happen with the country. But now I feel, and I still feel this way, even though I've lost a little bit of my idealism from the 60s, that there are so many things that have happened in the last 8 years of the Bush administration, that this world is in crisis with global warming, with the resurgence of Russia, with the lack of diplomacy and respect that the United States has just ditched its responsibilities towards the rest of the world in this reckless war.
And David, I'm going to leave it there, but you got the point across. And as I say, a number of other people are also calling in or writing in to express it. So, Chris, I don't want to linger on it too much, but
no, I just got to say, good for them. I'm glad people are worked up and feel that. But to make a generalization, you know, not that New York is better than anywhere else, but I think if you travel across this country, you'd find a lot more people worried about their, you know, $4 gallon of gas than about the issues that the caller just cited. And
well, I think
more people were in worked up. And I still don't think the comparison
right.
to the 60s is quite that feeling.
You know what, listeners, this is a good one for you to continue through the afternoon on our comments page. So even though it says RFK and Obama, how about that? Should there be more of an urgency to the issues of today than in the 1960s? For some of you who lived through that time, or some of you who didn't, is this a comparison even worth making? Or what do you think about the way it was made, either by Chris earlier or by the caller? I want to read a couple of these comments from the comments page. I, like many born after 1968, are mystified by the necrophilia that surrounds the Kennedy family. JFK increased the number of troops in Vietnam, authorized the wiretaps of MLK, and did very little on civil rights. And despite Mr. Hamill's claims, RFK didn't accomplish anything. It's very easy to say what he and JFK might have done had they lived, since there's no way to disprove it. However, any student of politics knows that campaign promises are often destroyed in the buzzsaw of governance. And someone else goes even further. He says, the cult of Kennedy, this is comment 12 if you're on our page, folks, Evan. It says, one more comment. The cult of Kennedy is at least partly responsible for the GOP's dominance of American politics for the last 25-plus years. While the Dems were looking for the next charismatic figure, a la JFK, RFK, to lead them to greatness, the GOP built a machine from the ground up that is, notwithstanding the past 2 years, dominated American politics at every level. Professor Harris, want to respond to those commenters?
Well, actually, it's interesting. I think there's a lot of truth to those comments. And I think it's a part of the separation of one generation to the next, a generation who have direct experience, a part of the collective memory of the assassination, who, you know, 30, 40 years hence, see the 1960s, at least aspects of it, as a time of hope and optimism. Whereas a generation that didn't have direct experience, they are more students of history, right? They've had the opportunity, and historians have had the opportunity to write about the Kennedy administration, the Kennedys, the contradictions of that, and as well as the transformation of American politics from the 60s on to the 80s and toward the 21st century. So that's oftentimes the battle surrounding memory. One, a memory based on autobiographical experience, and memories based on history, and how oftentimes that autobiographical memory can sometimes lapse into nostalgia.
We're going to get one more call on here. Then we're going to go on to the New York, the longtime New York Times political writer Joyce Pernick on this idea that Mayor Bloomberg may want to try to suspend term limits and run for a third term. Chris Smith from New York Magazine, I'm sure you'll be on that in the next week. But let me get Mark in Manhattan in here on RFK and Obama. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'll be brief because I know you guys have little time. First and foremost, amen to your last statement. It seems that every time there's a young standard bearer, i.e. Bill Clinton was compared to the Kennedys, and after he became president, ingrained himself with the Kennedy family. There was many comparisons. There were many commentators stating he was an honorary Kennedy. In fact, if you recall, when John Jr., when his plane crashed, Bill Clinton authorized the use of our Navy, and it was almost like he was part of his family. So we see that a lot. And also another comparison that you have is with Hillary Clinton and Bobby Kennedy. People state that Bobby was a very pugnacious fighter. However, he was a politician above all things. He did not get into the 1968 nomination until LBJ had a poor showing in the first primary, and Bobby Kennedy did not come out.
Right.
Bobby Kennedy did not run. In fact, he was sticking his finger in the air to see which way the wind was blowing.
But if you don't mind, I want to get to the point that you told my screener, which brings us up to the present, which is that Bill Clinton had the JFK mantle in 1992.
Absolutely.
To some degree. And so your question is, does this always happen to someone young?
Anyone young that is the Democratic, quote-unquote, new standard bearer will always be linked to JFK just because of everything that you've stated. He's part of your I'm younger. I'm only 20. Mm-hmm. I'm only 26. So anyone that's older that's lived through that is always going to look nostalgically at a young JFK and say, "Oh, is this the next JFK?"
Mark, thank you very much for that. Chris Smith, before you go, real quick, why didn't RFK Jr. join this parade? He endorsed Hillary, and so did a few others.
Right, partly out of a personal connection. You know, Hillary was serving in his father's Senate seat. Hillary had worked with him on a number of environmental issues over the years. He just thought she was a better candidate and more capable of beating the Republicans, and he endorsed her very early on before Obama had really caught fire. To touch on two things really quick, yes, and I say this in the column, there are enormous political differences between Obama and JFK, in particular, where they were on the conservative liberal spectrum. And that's part of the reason I think that Obama has kept somewhat of a distance. And secondly, that Bill Clinton very much hungered for that inheritance of the Kennedy dynasty, you know, and Obama hasn't. And I think that's healthy in all sorts of ways, both on a personal level and potentially for the country. He enjoys the association with the idealism and the imagination, but he's not obsessed with becoming a honorary Kennedy in any way.
So I'll wrap this up with one more comment from the comments board in response to the others that I read before. This says, "I was 17 when Bobby was shot, and my first thought was, what's the point of even trying?" And he goes, "I will vote for Obama not for his position on any issue, but because of the deafening approval I heard from the crowd in St. Paul the other night. He is about organization. He, like Jack and Martin and Bobby, can look into the camera and speak in a way in which people can believe and act. A man who can move the people can overcome any congressional political obstacle." True or not? Obama is moving people like Commenter 13 on our board there to feel and to write things like that. So Chris Smith, political columnist for New York Magazine, Frederick Harris, director of the Center on African-American Politics and Society at Columbia University. Thank you both very much for spending all this time with us today.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up in a minute. Change the New York City charter? Allow Michael Bloomberg to run for a third term? Stay tuned.